Today is Wednesday, June 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up, the Netherlands charges three Russians and a Ukrainian with murder in the downing of MH17.
Calamar downplayed the focus on a single person. She wrote that her focus was mainly on identifying those who may have failed in or abused their positions of authority.
Also ahead, a new United Nations report calls for more investigation into the murder of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and an Australian state has become the first in the country to approve a euthanasia law. It's all on today's International Edition. In our top story today, in the Netherlands, the head of the international team investigating the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 in 2014 today said it has charged three Russians and a Ukrainian with murder in the case. 298 people died when the jet crashed in eastern Ukraine. Investigators say the plane was shot down by a Russian missile. Separatists in eastern Ukraine, backed by Moscow, have been fighting an insurgency against the KYIV government for several years. The Dutch chief prosecutor says it is likely the suspects will be tried in absentia when the trial begins next March. Russia is not expected to hand them over for trial. In Moscow, the Russian government said the charges are based on unfounded allegations. Bogdan Tsupin in London has been covering the story for VOA's Ukrainian service, and he's on the line with us now. Hi, Bogdan.
Good afternoon.
Hi, yes. So let's start with a summary of the Dutch prosecutor's charges today. What can you tell us?
Well, the main thing that we heard today from the Netherlands was the naming of four suspects. And not only that, the Dutch prosecutors said that their cases, with the evidences collected, are being sent to the Dutch courts, and that the procedures, the criminal procedures, are going to start next March in 2020. That means that for the first time in 5 years, the relatives of the 298 victims of this crash are hoping to see justice. They were asking for it, and today we had many people, many relatives in the Netherlands, hoping that not only those four persons, but also people responsible higher up the command of the chain command will be held responsible for that with the time. They hope that this is just the beginning.
How are Ukrainians responding to this?
Well, Ukraine, of course, is very involved in this part. We must say that no Ukrainians died in this crash, but obviously this happens in the Ukrainian sky. And for Ukraine, the MH17 case is very, very important because the war, the conflict is still going on, and Ukraine is trying to push Russia out of its territory. Ukraine is trying to persuade the international community that Russia is breaking international law. And this case will be another proof that Russia is involved, that Russia is supporting and arming this military forces, or rebel forces, as they sometimes called in the east of Ukraine, and supplying it with sophisticated weapons, like, for example, this Buk rocket that was used for shooting down this airliner. So for Ukraine, it's very, very important, and of course, Ukraine is the part of the joint investigation team, the team that represents five countries that are conducting the investigation. And, of course, they are very interested in pushing this case into the court procedures next year.
Now, Russia has condemned the charges and allegations that a Russian missile shot down the plane, MH17. So what does Moscow say caused the crash?
Well, over the 5 years, the Moscow line was pretty consistent in mainly denying any involvement of Russia. And that was repeated today. I looked through the Russian Foreign Ministry statement today. But apart from repeating the line that is that we can hear from Moscow regularly over these 5 years, it's interesting to note that Moscow today makes this kind of situation by not even mentioning those four people that were named as a suspect. Russia is playing this kind of a role of ignorance, and they are not even mentioning that there are names of these people, that three of them are Russian citizens, and the fourth is probably in the Russia-controlled territories or maybe in Russia itself. And the Dutch prosecutors were asking today Russia for help. They were asking to at least interview those people, to interrogate them, and they were offering for those people, mostly Russian citizens, to come to Netherlands and defend themselves in the Dutch courts. We had nothing mentioned, no mention of that from Russia, from Moscow today.
Okay, great. Thank you. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks so much, Bogdan Supin in London. And you've been covering the story for us. Thank you very much. Well, as tensions between the United States and Iran continue to rise, members of the U.S. House of Representatives today are hearing testimony on the White House policy on Iran. Many members of the Democratic Party in the House are concerned about President Donald Trump's moves toward Iran. Trump last year pulled the U.S. out of a multilateral agreement limiting Tehran's ability to develop nuclear weapons. The administration since then has ratcheted up economic sanctions on Iran. The administration also blames Iran for a series of attacks on ships in the Persian Gulf, the vital waterway traveled by ships carrying oil. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson is covering the hearing today, and she joins us by phone to bring us the latest. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Well, Catherine, what is the focus of this hearing this afternoon?
Well, the hearing this afternoon is really an opportunity for Hill lawmakers to hear from one of the Trump administration's top diplomats at the U.S. State Department, who is working intensely on this issue. And he's been informing lawmakers in this first hour of the hearing that the administration is doing everything it can to avoid war, that they are really seeking an opportunity to bring Iran to the negotiating table and create a new, better reality for the Iranian people after an agreement is reached.
Also, what concerns do members of the House have about the administration's Iran policy?
Well, what really is striking about this hearing is how differently that multilateral Iran nuclear agreement from 2015 is being viewed by Republicans and by Democrats up on Capitol Hill. Democrats are concerned that because the administration withdrew from that agreement, Iran no longer has a incentive to really play by the international community's rules. Now, of course, Republicans and the member of the Trump administration who's testifying see that very differently. They're saying that they had to withdraw from this agreement in order to bring Iran back to the negotiating table and negotiate a better agreement. So that's really one of the top concerns. Another concern is going to be whether or not Congress will have a say if the Trump administration does indeed enter into a conflict with Iran.
Also, is any congressional action expected on Iran?
That's really where we're going to hear for next from U.S. lawmakers. They're concerned that the authorization for the use of military force, which is basically the mechanism for Congress declaring war, is really and truly outdated. The last time that lawmakers passed one was in 2001, in the days just after the September 11th terrorist attacks. And really what Democrat lawmakers are arguing is they're saying that that authorization doesn't have any language that approaches the situation with Iran, the one that we're in now, and then it needs to be updated.
Okay, great. That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson providing us with an update on the hearing today and bringing us the latest on Iran. Among the top stories in the world, members of the U.S. House of Representatives today question Hope Hicks, a former aide to U.S. President Donald Trump, in its investigation of Russian election interference. President Trump kicks off his campaign for the 2020 election, and the internet is back on in Ethiopia after several days of unexplained outages. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, citing credible evidence, an independent UN human rights expert investigating the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi recommended an investigation into the possible role of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman today. The Saudi government has blamed the killing on rogue officers and denied the government or Prince Salman were involved. VOA Steve Miller has more.
The 101-page report released by Agnes Callamard into the October killing of Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul calls on UN bodies or Secretary General Antonio Guterres to demand a follow-up criminal investigation. She noted the extreme sensitivity of considering the criminal responsibility of the Crown Prince, as well as a senior advisor to the Saudi royal court who has not been charged. However, Callamard downplayed the focus on a single person. She wrote that her focus was mainly on identifying those who may have failed in or abused their positions of authority. 11 people are on trial in Saudi Arabia in largely secret proceedings, and 5 could face the death penalty. Callamard wrote that she obtained access to a recording of the killing on October 2nd, and she had received information about a financial package offered to Khashoggi's children. Callamard also noted limitations on her inquiry, which began in January. She received no response to her request to travel to Saudi Arabia. She wrote that she had received only a total of 45 minutes of tapes recorded within the consulate around the time of the killing, despite Turkish intelligence referencing some 7 hours of recordings. The U.S. State Department has publicly designated 16 people for their roles in the killing of Khashoggi. Many U.S. lawmakers have also criticized U.S. President Donald Trump for not condemning Saudi Arabia for the journalist's killing. Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Steve. The UN Human Rights Office is calling for a prompt, impartial investigation into the sudden death Monday of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi in a Cairo court. Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected president, collapsed during a hearing on the espionage charges against him. The spokesman for the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Rupert Colville, says the exact cause of Morsi's death is not clear. Egyptian authorities say Morsi died of a heart attack. Colville says under international humanitarian law, any sudden death in custody must be followed by a thorough, independent investigation to clarify the cause of death. But he tells VOA the state which was responsible for Morsi's well-being should not carry out the investigation. Morsi, who was ousted by a military coup in 2013, 1 year after taking office, reportedly suffered from diabetes and other serious health problems. Colville says it seems Morsi may have been deprived of the health care he needed. Also today, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he thinks Morsi was killed. In a speech, he said the former Egyptian leader flailed in the courtroom for 20 minutes and received no help. Well, the Egyptian constitution stipulates that Egyptians have the right to own and issue newspapers and establish visual, audio, and digital media outlets. It also bans the government from censoring, confiscating, suspending, or shutting down Egyptian media outlets in any way. However, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Egypt ranks as one of the top jailers of journalists worldwide. The Egyptian government has targeted critical or independent news outlets and has blocked more than 500 websites, including journalistic sites. Doki Fassian, director of the Middle East program at Freedom House, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawi about Press Freedom in Egypt.
We obviously at Freedom House do track freedom of the press, and what we've seen is a dramatic deterioration in the last several years, starting in around 2013 and has intensified since 2018. What we have seen is violations of the right to expression and freedom of the press, violations of the Constitution through a new legislation passed by the Egyptian government, which regulates this sector, the Supreme Council for Media media regulations and the 2018 anti-cybercrime and information law. Both laws severely restrict and allow the government to regulate the press in Egypt. You know, journalists continue to be detained, harassed, imprisoned, and really convicted now for very long sentences, even life sentences. International journalists are often banned from reporting from inside the country, and obviously there are many blocks put on websites and foreign media outlet. And obviously the Egyptian government's even going further and trying to control the narrative inside the country by anyone who's reporting, even going as far as label and to categorize Egyptians who have a social media following of 5,000 or more followers as media outlet. So it's gotten to the point that the Egyptian government is trying to control what information Egyptians are consuming, and it's not to the benefit of the government, and it's not to the benefit of the Egyptian people.
Egyptian private media is said to have had gone under the control of the Egyptian general and military intelligence. Even journalist syndicate has grown increasingly supportive of the Sisi policies. Would the promotion of only government-approved narrative contribute to an environment that discourages open debate and encourages extremism?
Well, I think what we're seeing, unfortunately, is the spread of disinformation by the state through media being controlled by them. There's been a sort of co-opting of the media sector in Egypt. We're now seeing a whole new different situation in the country where there really is no press freedom at all. We can just look at, for example, the death of former President Morsi was barely covered. I mean, wasn't covered the way it would have been covered in a really free press. It does, I think, discourage open debate. There's obviously journalists are too fearful. You know, they're not going to be able to maintain their livelihood and work in Egypt if they do step out what the state is saying. So there is a discouraging of open debate. There is severe punishment that awaits any journalist that dare cross any of the lines the state has said. And I think in terms of extremism, I think if you're restricting people's access to information and you're not allowing people to have media literacy and digital literacy and just being able to fact check for themselves and have access to fact-based journalism, then you are to some degree making them more susceptible, you know, to bad information. And that's unfortunate because I think all of these restrictions and attacks on journalists are being done under, you know, the guise of fighting terrorism. And in fact, they might even be breeding it by not allowing Egyptians access to information that is genuine and fact-based.
That was Doki Fassian, Director of Middle East Program at Freedom House, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Elshinawi. Well, in the coming hour, the U.S. Federal Reserve Open Market Committee is expected to announce the outcome of its meeting over the past few days. Many financial analysts expect the Fed to show a softer stance on interest rates after several rate increases. U.S. stock markets were steady ahead of the announcement, although yields for U.S. bonds have risen. Jackie Quinn with the Associated Press has more.
The Federal Reserve seems ready to pivot from keeping interest rates steady to holding out the option of cutting rates if the economic expansion appears to need a boost. While some analysts are predicting a rate cut could be announced at the Fed's next meeting next month, others think the policymakers will hold the line, awaiting the outcome of trade talks between President Trump and China's leader. The central bank will be updating its forecast for economic growth, employment, inflation, and interest rates. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Australia's only euthanasia laws have come into force today in the state of Victoria. Only residents over the age of 18 who are in intolerable pain with a terminal illness that will likely cause death within a year will be eligible. The Catholic Church has, however, warned of a new and deeply troubling chapter of health care. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In the end, death will be swift for those patients in the state of Victoria whose cases have been approved by doctors. An assisted dying kit will be delivered to their home, and a lethal drug is mixed and swallowed. Death would likely occur after about an hour, after the patient has become drowsy and become unconscious. Officials say the legislation has dozens of safeguards to prevent terminally ill people being pressured into ending their lives. The Victorian State Premier is Daniel Andrews.
This is about giving to Victorians who have a terminal illness and are in the terminal phase of that illness and have unbearable pain and suffering, the option, the dignified choice that should be theirs.
But critics say there's widespread opposition to euthanasia within Australia's medical and religious communities. In a letter, senior Catholic bishops said they couldn't cooperate with the facilitation of suicide, even when it seems motivated by empathy or kindness. Euthanasia laws have recently been rejected by other Australian states, but the Western Australian Parliament is expected to consider an assisted dying bill in August, while authorities in Queensland are exploring similar options. Ingrid Iflar, a lung cancer patient in New South Wales state, hopes legislation becomes nationwide.
Wish I could die, you know, and have it over and done with. I'm sick of my life. I'm just sitting down on the chair, looking out the door. If I do something, I get breathless. I'm not in a good way with doing things.
Australia's Northern Territory was the first jurisdiction in the world to explicitly legalise euthanasia in 1996. It was overturned by the federal government the following year. The legislation was in force for 9 months, during which time 4 people died by medically assisted suicide. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
Do you think eating food or drinking beverages with a lot of sugar or other simple carbohydrates will provide you with a quick burst of energy, some call a sugar rush? A number of people around the world have long linked sugar with delivering an instant surge of hyperactivity. But according to a new study published in Neuroscience and Biobehavioral Reviews, this is just a myth. The study suggests sugar doesn't cause the so-called sugar rush, and it virtually has no effect on your mood, regardless of how much sugar you ingest. The British and German study authors say they have actually found the opposite to be true, that sugar increases tiredness and decreases alertness within an hour after it is consumed. The researchers made their findings after analyzing data gathered from 31 previously conducted studies. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
A lawyer for the former French president Nicolas Sarkozy says he will face trial after the country's highest court rejected his final bid to have the influence peddling charges against his case thrown out. Sarkozy is accused of offering to help a judge win promotion in return for leaked information about a separate inquiry. He has denied any wrongdoing. The charges are the result of the investigation into allegations that late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi funded Sarkozy's 2007 election campaign. His attorneys argue the use of wiretapped remarks obtained in a different investigation violate European Court of Human Rights rules. Well, you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Jackson Mvuganyi, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa. Across the United States are numerous African diaspora associations. Many strive to preserve their culture or have advocacy goals. The role of the African diaspora in the United States.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Emerson T. Brooking, defense analyst and resident fellow at the Digital Forensic Research Lab at the Atlantic Council, discusses his timely new book, Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media, with host Carol Castiel and VOA assistant producer Mitch Biter. The book explores the collision of war, politics, and social media. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time